"Tell on," quoth the king, who chanced to be sleepless and restless, and therefore was pleased with the prospect of hearing her story. So Shahrazad rejoiced, and thus, on the first night of the storytelling, she began with the tale of the traitor and the genie.
Got a little new setup here today. Sitting out here, smoking some cigars.
It's Lent, so there's no whiskey, but
yeah,
soon maybe. We'll see if that helps or makes the podcast worse. But got a Monte Cristo White Series cigar. I don't think I've had one of these since college.
Yeah, I have no idea. I'm not a cigar enthusiast. I kind of wish I was that person. So I don't know if that's a good one or if that's a bad one. Or mm-hmm.
It's pretty nice right now.
Yeah.
For me, although it's a little bit dried out. But it's pretty nice. I'm more of a pipe smoker myself,
mm-hmm.
but every now and then a cigar is a good choice. So what do you got?
From your kindness, you gave me a Flathead 660.
Man, your kindness, that's great. It's almost your highness, which is very fitting.
I wouldn't take it that far. Yeah, I don't know if I'd want to identify myself with some of these kings in Arabian Nights.
No, I mean, it depends on how you look at the world, I guess.
Yeah. So we are finally doing our podcast over Arabian Nights. We kind of had to postpone it because we underestimated how long this book would be. Today's finally here, though. And, like, full disclosure, though, too, I didn't finish the whole thing. I didn't read every story in here. I tried to read the big ones or the ones that kind of caught my eye.
Yeah, I didn't get through the whole thing either.
Yeah, and I don't know if it was just maybe the language is hard. Not like the Arabic language, because this is based in the Middle East and predominantly Muslim culture. It was translated by Sir Robert Burton, and it's Old English. And so it's like heavy old English. And so I don't know if that was maybe a reason that was...
I mean, it's not old English like Beowulf, but it's definitely King James Version of the Bible, old English.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was thinking of, yeah.
Old English is like a totally different language.
Oh, really?
Yeah. This is our language, but way more proper than us.
Yeah, KJV. And it's like, you got to read something twice to kind of pull from the context on what they're saying. And yes, I don't know if that was the reason why it was kind of a tough read. But once you got past that, there really was some pretty imaginative stories here. I feel like that was kind of the whole point of it being on John Senior's list, or at least one of them.
Yeah, certain ones would draw you in and you would totally be there. And then other ones, it's just every page was a fight to slog through.
Yeah.
And I think we have a shortened version of this book in general. Mm-hmm. I think the original translation's like 13 different volumes that you can buy.
Yeah.
And so we're definitely not reading all of those. But we do have the 700-page Sir Richard Burton translation.
I mean, that just kind of goes to show how great of a collection of stories this is. Even though it's not necessarily like Western, what we would consider Western literature, it is 12 volumes of just short stories. I did some research beforehand, like I should have. And the guy who originally translated them wasn't actually Sir Richard Burton. The one who compiled them, I think he was a Frenchman. I could be getting that wrong. But he kind of did the legwork on putting the stories into one compilation, you know? But Sir Richard Burton is the one who first translated it into, like, readable, easily accessible English.
For the most part, accessible English. But he also did have an affinity for himself for Arabian culture.
Yeah.
And he spent some time in the Middle East getting mm-hmm. to know the people. And that certainly changed his perspective on these stories. A lot of the commentary about who he was as a person made him seem like a... Definitely a degenerate for some of the things that he adds into this story.
He's a very polarizing figure. Some people are like, yeah, what he did was wonderful. He translated these stories and he made them accessible for people, but he was not a good man. That's what a lot of the consensus is, that he was kind of a degenerate.
But it's always hard for us to look back in our time and to assume that somebody was like that, especially when they're critics of the day. He certainly had his critics of his day as well. But it's hard for us to look back and to understand the cultural context by which they were living and going through, because if we had lived at that time, we might have thought differently about who he was and
yeah.
his feats, possibly.
Yes and no. I mean, I think there was some evidence that was thrown around that he was a degenerate in the sense of, like, kind of the more racy themes in the book. But like you said, it is hard to judge someone who lived back then when we didn't live in the culture, right? The mm-hmm. culture has a lot to do with how we act,
yeah.
you know, and what we write.
And is degenerate for his day... You know, he's not doing OnlyFans, so it's still not to the level of depravity that we see in our day, of full-on prostitution being celebrated in our culture. But he definitely does make comments about sexuality in the book.
Yeah.
But there's a trigger warning, I guess.
A little bit, yeah. Just a little, I mean, I don't know if anyone will ever be listening to this podcast with their kids.
Yeah.
But it was kind of hard to get around and hard to wrestle with as why this book was on his list for nursery-aged kids. And I feel like one obvious reason is the fantasy and just the fantastical world that is written about. But also, there's some really racy themes in this book with regards to, like, sex and slaves and women. And so it's like, I don't know. Like, I don't know how I feel about it.
We definitely did go the more idealistic route on this because John Sr. gives us two different translations that he recommends. And he doesn't technically recommend this translation. I guess he says that it's the classic version. Mm-hmm. But he says to use the Edward Lang version of it for children. And neither of us got that. So I bought the Andrew Lang version, but that's not the same thing. Edward Lang was a guy who was writing his version at the same time that Sir Richard Burton was. And supposedly there was problems with, I guess, him being able to get the book out to people. And he wasn't able to do that as well as Sir Richard Burton was in terms of just publishing it.
Yeah.
So his version has kind of been lost and downplayed, although his version might be far superior.
The story starts off really bad. I read the intro story, kind of sets up the whole 1001 Nights, and was like, okay,
yeah,
this is not okay. So, if every story is like this, I'm probably never going to pick this book up again.
Yeah. The introduction story is basically the red pill on marriage. I mean, it really is.
You know, and if you're not familiar with the red pill movement, like, women are bad. Sleep with whoever you want. Do whatever they want. Women are awful, so you should just sleep with them and not have any commitment to them kind of thing.
Never get married.
Never get married.
In a sense, that's the whole book. The whole book is every woman is a harlot. And if she's not a harlot, then she at least messes things up, even in the best cases of, like, Aladdin. She's still the one that's messing things up.
It's an interesting premise, right? Because the book's either called Arabian Nights or 1001 Nights.
There's these two brothers who are kings, and they get separated. They go their separate ways in the kingdom, but they both still have such a respect for each other. One of the kings sends off to another king because he wants for him to come back and see him before he dies. And so as his younger brother king is going into his kingdom, he makes a stop and goes back home for the day because he forgets something. And in the midst of that, he sees his wife sleeping with a slave.
Yeah.
And then her handmaids are also sleeping with these slaves. And it was so disgusting to him that he goes in and he slays her and the slave.
Yep.
And then he goes on to his brother, who's a king. Of course, he's sad for the first couple days. And his brother doesn't understand why. And eventually he's happy again. The older brother, who's the king, asks him, well, what changed? Why were you so downcast and now you're happy? The young king says, something really depraved happened that I witnessed. But then I came here and witnessed that your wife did the same thing. Now, I guess it's not seen as such a depraved thing.
Well, the second king's was worse. The first king, his wife was just sleeping with one of the slaves. But the second king's wife, the main story's king, she was doing depraved things with multiple people. Multiple people. And so he saw that as, oh, your plight is worse than mine. So I can't be as mad as you're about to be.
And so the older king forces him to tell him and says, no, you have to tell me what happened. And he tells him. This king eventually goes on a tirade and kills her and kills the slaves.
Yep.
But they go off together to see if any woman be good in the universe. And they're sitting at, like, I guess, I think it's a river.
It's a beach or a river or something like that.
They see this beautiful woman and she's there with her husband and her husband falls asleep. And then she makes them to come make love with her.
Yeah.
And they don't want to do it. But she's like, if you don't do it, I'm going to wake my husband and he's going to kill you. And so then they see the depravity of women. So they kind of take the red pill on marriage, swear off all women. Yeah. But now the whole premise of the book is that from now on, the king every night will take one woman from his kingdom. He will lay with her, marry her for the night. And in the morning, he has this guy kill her. And so finally, the guy who's doing the killing has a daughter who he loves. And she says that she wants to save the kingdom.
Because I think at this point in the story, it's been going on for a week. All the public and the citizens are like fleeing the city with their daughters and their wives because they don't want them to get killed. So there's no women left. And he's like, bring me a woman. And the guy's like, there's no one left. And
this is my daughters.
Just his daughters. And like you said, his daughter volunteers and she goes in with the king and lays with him, and then as the night goes on, before the morning, the sun rises, she wakes up, sends for her sister. Her sister comes.
Begs her to tell her a story.
Begs her to tell her a story, and the king agrees to hear this story. And one thing that I found out was that since we have a shortened version of this, it kind of jumps from story to story, but the way that she keeps her head is that she uses cliffhangers. She'll stop the story and say, "You'll have to let me live, and you can find out the end of the story." And the king's like, "Well, I got to hear the end of the story." So he lets her live. And so basically, that's the premise of the book. And all of these stories within this book is her telling the king these stories. So it's like Storyception, you know?
So she stays awake or alive for 101 nights.
1,001
nights. Or 1,001 nights, that's right. And at the end of the story, he essentially, you know, his heart is softened, like Rowdy said, and he lets her live and they're married.
Yeah.
So that kind of shapes the entire story, the entire worldview on women as well.
Yeah.
Which makes sense, because if you read these stories in a vacuum, you're like, man, these people just hated women. Every story has a bad woman. I mean, if they're not harlots, then they're just dumb and make the mistakes. They're all Eves. It doesn't have a good view of women.
Yeah, that's the point.
I'm hoping that it's the context with which these stories are told, although these are old folk stories in general, or that's what you're made to believe by the writers of the book. And I hope it's not just something that the culture was necessarily that depraved, where
yeah.
it just views women in that way. And some of this also might just be stereotypes of Sir Richard Burton putting on Definitely. The Arabic people.
Well, one thing that's interesting, too, is that these stories were and are way more popular in the West than they ever were in the East. Like, Muslim culture, they know about them, but it's like, okay, what about it? Doesn't really represent an Arabic high society. It's more of low society tales. And so they were popularized in the West, and I think they were so popular is because it's got a kind of an unknown to it. Like, people have never experienced this culture. So I think that's why it was super popular.
Yeah, they might have never seen a Muslim person in real life before when they were reading this book for the first time. And so there's a little bit of exciting, and maybe for the old men, they really enjoyed the book for certain reasons. Maybe it was a little bit saucy.
Which brings me back to the question is, like, why do we think John Sr. put this book on his list? In his list, he divides it up to, like, nursery age, adolescence, teen years, and then, like, college years. And this book is in 1 to 9-year-old range, mm-hmm. or 2 to 9-year-old range. John Sr. believed that this is something that we should read to our kids. So why do we think he did that?
The question might be, what is the whole purpose of this book?
Probably just the wonder of the stories. Because, I mean, you have genies, there's magic, there's kings and queens and adventure. So, I mean, I feel like if anything were to make John Sr. put this on his list, it's that. It's the imagination of the stories and being able to utilize your imagination while you're reading. And to really just try to enter into a story like this, you know, something otherworldly.
It certainly is a retraining of the imagination.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's right. I think even before that step, though, to me, the importance of this whole book and a common theme that comes throughout is that storytelling is extremely important. And storytelling is actually what moves people.
Mm-hmm.
The stories that we tell other people about lives that other people live, or the way that we live, the stories that we tell ourselves, which change our perspective of ourselves, helping us to accomplish feats or not, you know, whether we think something is impossible or possible, the kind of person that we tell ourselves that we are. Storytelling matters, and it's something that we've lost in our generation. I fall more into this category, always have. Would be more of the facts don't care about your feelings generation, which are like, oh, just give them the brute facts.
Yeah.
And here it's like, no, actually, if you want to change somebody's perspective on something, we shouldn't just give them the brute facts. That may or may not work. But people don't change their life just based on some brute facts.
Yeah.
But they might want to give their life for something beautiful, and that's in the story.
One example, I don't know if I read it in Bethel's book or if I heard it somewhere, but it was the idea of, like, courage. You can tell someone the definition of courage, whatever that is, but it doesn't hit the same as when you read a story of someone being courageous. And that just shows the power of what a story can do.
John Sr. talks about it, but he gets it from John Henry Newman. People wouldn't give up their lives for a philosophy. But these stories that we tell have a huge impact, and so I think a lot of it is that. Because in many of these stories, we see people being kept alive because of the stories they tell. So there's one story, and I forget the name of it, where a guy is, he goes on a journey, and he's eating these plums, and he's taking the pits out of the middle, and he throws it, and it goes, and it kills a guy. And he doesn't know, so he's just sitting by the tree. And all of a sudden, this huge guy walks up to him, and he says, I need to kill you. You killed my son. And he's like, of course I didn't kill your son. I have no idea who you are. I've never met your son in your life. He said, did you throw that rock? And he says, yes. So he begs for his life, and he gives him a year to go back and set everything in order at his house. And he does set everything in order. Tells his wife bye. He's a man of his honor, so he comes back. The next year, the guy comes to kill him. But before that, three guys come along the road, and they ask him why he's there in such a dark place. And he tells them what's going on, so they stay just to wait to hear what happens. And when the guy gets there to kill him, the other three guys are so upset that they make a plea for his life. And they said, I will tell you a story, and if you find this story fantastic, then I want you to spare a third of his life. And the next guy does the same thing, and the next guy does the same thing. And basically, by sparing a third of his life through these magnificent stories, he is saved ultimately. The guy doesn't kill him after all. And there's many stories like that throughout this book.
Well, it's also the whole book. Mm-hmm. The stories is what's keeping her alive. The stories that she tells is keeping her alive and how amazing they are. Because after every story, she says, oh, if you thought that one was good, wait till you hear the next one. It goes to show of how powerful a well-told story is.
And it made me think a lot because that's the way our Lord taught as well. He taught in parables. Mm-hmm. He didn't teach by telling people, here's the four last things. This is what you need to know. Yeah. Here's transubstantiation. He didn't say that God is merciful. Rather, he gives the story of the prodigal son to show you that. And it's deeper with the story than it would ever be if he would just tell us, well, God is merciful.
Yeah.
It's in knowing that that the dad is waiting for the son and watching for him, and that he runs to him, and that he slaughters the fattened calf and all of that. That really gives you deeper insight into who God is as a father.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if Jesus had just said, my father is merciful, well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Tell us the story.
That's what John Sr. was getting at. Like what all we just talked about is his whole reason for adding this book. But one thing I have to wrestle with, especially in our over-sexualized culture, is gaining the wonder of this book, is that worth the price to pay in exposing your children or whoever you're reading this to those things?
Well, see, and I think the distinction might be this isn't the version that Senior wanted to be read to kids.
Yeah.
He said there's an expurgated version for kids by Edward Link. Obviously, there's innuendo in all books, especially pertaining to love.
I want to expose my kids to real life. I don't want it to all be like this nerfed Disney wimpy
what
stuff,
does nerf
right?
mean? Like,
I guess that's my previous gamer life coming at me. Like when you nerf a character, you make them weaker.
Okay.
If you have a character that's like really kind of overpowered, you one of the terms like you nerf him.
I thought about the Family Guy version of Star Wars, and they're like, you nerf herder. I don't know what that meant. I mean, that might be actually in Star Wars. I have no idea.
I don't think it is.
So that's how little I know about Star Wars. I apologize, good people out there, or people of goodwill.
People of goodwill.
Forgive me for my ignorance on Star Wars.
Oh, we don't have to get into the new stuff coming out of Star Wars, man. Oh my goodness. We'll save that for the next political podcast.
Well, I love hearing people talk about it. I've got priest friends and other friends who absolutely love Star Wars and just talk about it all the time. I'm like, cool. You know, I'll be a part of the conversation and make stupid comments here or there, but
I don't want to not expose my kids to the darkness of the real world because mm-hmm. I want them to know that there's dragons out there, that there's bad things out there, you know, that murder is a real thing. You can lose your life. There's bad people. I don't want them to think that life's just a fairy tale all the time and they're going to get whatever they want because that's just not how it goes. But there's no reason to expose them for stuff that's like pornographic in the sense of it's just doing it because there's no reason for it. It goes into some weird details. And like when I first opened it, was reading, I was like, oh man, this is going to be a long couple weeks. But
that's right.
With that being said, not every story is like that. I was pleasantly surprised with some of them. Like, one of my favorites was Sinbad. I know this wasn't your favorite, but I really thoroughly enjoyed The Tale of Sinbad. Popular title is Sinbad and the Seven Seas or something like that. This one's just called Sinbad the Sailor.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed that one because it didn't have all that racy stuff in it. It was just about a man going out on the sea and like having these wild adventures.
Yeah, and it's kind of fun at the very beginning because there's another Sinbad who's slaving away at something, and I forget what it is. He's slaving away, and I'm getting it confused a little bit with Aesop's Fables, because there's a story of a man who basically sees that the grass is greener on the other side, and he wants to go off and be a merchant, whereas he's a farmer. And so I'm like, okay, was that Sinbad, the original guy, not the sailor? Did he try that and come back? But I think that's Aesop's, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the main moral. If you want to pull a moral out of Sinbad the Sailor, it's that he never learns his lesson. Because he goes out on these, like, I think it's 7 voyages, maybe?
Yes.
I could be getting the number wrong. But it's 7 voyages, and every single time, he just meets disaster. And he has these awful experiences, but they always kind of end well, and he gets to come back home, and he gets all the riches and everything.
He comes back filthy rich.
Yeah, filthy rich. But then always he grows tired of his current situation and wants to go out and experience the world again.
He quickly forgets all the hardship that he went through.
Yeah. And so that's the moral of it.
And basically every story, I think all 7 of the stories, he's shipwrecked, essentially. So, which is crazy, but also you hear St. Paul, he was like, I was shipwrecked twice. You know, like, how common of an occurrence was this? To me, if I'm shipwrecked once, I'm dead forever. There's no way I'm surviving a shipwreck. Yeah. I would die of a heart attack at the ship going down, you know, and I'm a decent swimmer, but come on. That's...
Nah, man, you're going to sink like a rock, bro.
That's wild. I did like the stories. I felt sometimes they were harder to get into with Sinbad the Sailor, but that also kind of depends on what time of the day I'm reading them. Because if I'm reading them in the morning right after my first cup of coffee, great. After a long day at work.
Yeah.
You know, I might be less there.
I think that's the language, because at least for me, it took me a minute to adjust. Every single time I started reading, it took me a minute to adjust. And once I finally got adjusted, I was in it. I was good. But those first couple pages, it was a battle to get through. And I think that's just the language of it.
Oh, yeah. So basically, Sinbad is walking down the street. He's just like a day laborer or something. And he sees this awesome guy's house. And he's like, oh, Allah be praised. But why does Allah allow me to go through this hardship when this guy probably did nothing and has this huge house? And so Sinbad the Voyager is inside and he overhears it and he's talking to his friends. And he says, summon that man and bring him in here. And so, of course, the other Sinbad's like, oh, man, I done messed up. This guy's going to beat me or something. And he's like, no, come. I want to tell you my story of how I got all this. I didn't inherit all of this. This came through tragedy and courageous events and all the rest. And so then he begins telling him these stories over multiple days. Mm-hmm. And so it was that's kind of interesting. I mean, it does say that of nothing in life that's worth having ever comes easy.
No.
And that's one thing that Sinbad the Voyager says, is he's like, yeah, I've got all these riches, but do you want to go through what I've gone through? I mean, he was kind of an adventurous guy, though. He always forgot his lesson.
Yeah.
And went right back to it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if you want to have what he has in that very worldly sense.
I think that is a kind of a moral to that story, too, because they're both named Sinbad, and I think that's intentional.
That's a good point, because I'm like, he just ran out of names here. He's like, Sinbad and Sinbad. We're good.
But what's interesting, though, is that Sinbad and Aladdin, they weren't original Arabian Nights tales. The guy who originally translated these stories, because Aladdin, surprisingly, is a Chinaman.
Yeah. Right? Oh, yeah. Oh, so, we're going to get into that. That wrecked my world. I was like, what did Disney do? So when you're reading Aladdin, I mean, you're thinking, oh, well, this is Aladdin and Jasmine, and mm-hmm. they look just like the Disney characters did. But nope. Then it reminds you that he's a Chinaman.
Yeah. And so the guy who originally translated him, he was compiling all these stories. And I think the way I heard it told was that he heard these stories and he loved them so much, he figured that they would fit perfectly within this. And they do.
Those are my two favorite stories, and I don't think they fit at all. I think the main reason I liked the book was because I liked those two stories. And most of the other stories, I'm like, what in the world?
Yeah. But the Sinbad's good because it's the adventure. One of my favorite stories is that he ends up crashed on this island. I feel like that's the starting of every one of his stories.
Every single one.
But he goes on this island, and he encounters, this is like the second time he's encountered Aruka. The giant bird. And so he finds out he's in the middle of this valley. And so what merchants do is that they throw these dead carcasses off the mountain And they roll down the mountain, and with their flesh, they pick up all these precious stones. They get stuck in the carcass's body. And then the Ruka, the giant bird, comes and picks these like horses up and carries them back to the top of the mountain to eat them and drops the carcass. And then the merchants gather up all the jewels. Mm-hmm. And so Sinbad finds himself in the valley with no way to get out.
Yeah, and there's apparently they're like huge diamonds. And there's also snakes down there too that come out at night, which almost killed him. And he's like, the snakes are so big they could eat like a whale.
Yeah. That's one thing too, is the hyperbole here. It paints the story so well, because every time that any of the characters encounter like jewels, it's like no king has ever seen a jewel this big.
Yeah. Just imagine a snake so big that it could swallow an elephant.
Yeah.
And then this snake is out in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And it's only out at night. So what does he do? He finds a little bitty cave and he rolls a small rock in front of it because he has to go through a thing. Then he stays up the whole night terrified because he hears the hissing and the slithering.
But yeah, so he's in this valley, and the only way he can figure to get back to the top is they roll these carcasses off the mountain, and he just holds on to the carcass.
So for our dear listeners, how would you get to the top of this valley if you were in this situation and there's diamonds around? What would you do first? It's impossible to scale the walls, but you know that these huge birds come in during the day and grab the prey. What would you do?
Yeah, he like holds on to the bottom of the carcass as the bird is lifting it up, and he's just holding on to this carcass for dear life.
After he got tons of jewels, too.
Tons of jewels.
Because he always gets richer in these stories. Yeah,
he's a man of opportunity. He's always pocketing as many as he can while his life's in danger.
He's like, hell, I had to spend all my time with these snakes and these huge birds. I might as well get a bunch of big diamonds out of it.
Yeah.
So the bird swoops down, grabs the carcass, and he's underneath the carcass and all has all these jewels, and then takes him up and drops him. And somehow the merchants scare off the birds, mm-hmm. which is kind of crazy because these birds are humongous and just kill elephants or whatever quickly. Yeah. So that part is a little bit iffy, but they come off and they scare him somehow.
Well, it's funny because the birds are really fascinating, but the first story, he encounters this giant white dome in the ground, and it turns out to be a Ruka egg. And they crack it, and, you know, that goes on its own little adventure. And then, like, the fourth story, he's on this boat, and these guys are doing the same thing. They're out there, like, touching this Ruka egg, and he's on the boat like, don't do it!
Yeah. And also the rock, or the Ruka, is also mentioned in Aladdin, which is funny.
Is it?
It is. It's mentioned later on in Aladdin.
Yeah. See, so still, when you say Aladdin, I think about the Disney movie, and I'm like,
oh, yeah.
Really?
It's a common tale told throughout. Yeah, so that's awesome. So eventually, the merchant scares off the bird and finds the man is kind of surprised. And he's like, you have the best diamonds. What are you doing? This is my lot. And so he ends up making friends with the king and getting back to his home country eventually. Because that's how all these stories end. He always makes friends with the king. Somehow, the king's like, you're basically my son. Take all my riches. And then eventually, a boat shows up. And he's like, hey, I'm going back home, by the way, to Baghdad.
He had to have been such a charming man. And it is. He ends up befriending the king. The king gives him everything he ever wants, marries his daughters off to him.
Do you know why he was charming?
Why?
Because he's a good storyteller. Because that's always what it is with, that's what he's doing in the whole story. He's telling a story.
Yeah, every time he encounters like the people who are going to save him, he recounts everything that has befallen him.
Yep.
Right?
Because even a lot of times he's shipwrecked and the guys keep his gear. Years later, they come back around, and they still have his gear, and they're saying, oh, we're going to go back to Baghdad and give this to this man named Sinbad's family. And he hears the story, and he's like, I am that man.
Yeah.
I am Sinbad. Then they don't believe him. They're like, Allah be praised. Why would you say something like this?
Yeah.
You're just being opportunistic. And he's like, no, remember when I did this or that or whatever.
Yeah. He tells the story.
He's a storyteller, which saves his life, ultimately.
Which one thing that I found fascinating, too, is I try to get some other people's perspective on the book. There's a podcast called The Rest is History. It's got Tom Holland's a pretty frequent guy on there. He's a pretty popular historian, British historian. There's another gentleman on there. I forget his name. But they were talking about how some of Sinbad's stories, they kind of are super similar to Odysseus and Odysseus's story, especially like the Cyclops, like chunking the stones at the boat. And that's kind of what the Ruka did in like the fifth voyage. Mm-hmm. But also there's the giant, who's kind of like the Cyclops, and, you know, he's like eating all the men and like terrorizing them. And like in the whole Sinbad journeying home, that whole aspect, it's very similar to the story of Odysseus in the Odyssey.
Which makes perfect sense. I mean, we see that through all of these stories. There's also tons of allusions back to Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
One instance is anytime there's a spell that's cast, there's like a sprinkling of water, almost like a reverse baptismal rite that's done, and some words are said, this water sprinkled, and then this person changes into another person. There's a lot of that. Or even in Aladdin, basically, Princess Badur, whatever her name is, Lady Badur, she messes up twice, and it's kind of like being in the Garden of Eden, essentially. People come and they tempt her, and she falls into sin.
Yeah.
Not sin explicitly, but she just makes a stupid decision that takes the whole family for like a twist. But we see that a lot throughout the book, and I think it's the context that these people live, even to the point where in the Aladdin story, it's talking about a holy lady named Fatima, and it says that she's praying a rosary. And Rowdy was asking me, did Muslims pray rosaries?
Yeah, I was like, is this character in the story? Her name's Fatima, for one, which is like, okay. And she's like a religious lady who can do all these miracles. Mm-hmm. And I was like, because Christians and Jewish folk have, they make appearances in these stories. So I was like, okay, so is this like a Christian nun? Because it just mentioned her praying a rosary. But no.
But it's not. So the Muslims have prayer beads.
Because it mentions her, after that, it mentions her reading the Quran. So I'm like, okay, something's not.
Well, not her, but the Marabi or whatever, the magician who kills her and ultimately.
The Maghrabi?
Yeah, the Maghrabi. Like Sir Richard Burton used the context of the people's life to explain something that might be hard to explain. The Muslim people have a set of prayer beads. They don't call them rosary. It isn't the rosary, but they certainly do have a set of prayer beads. And it's interesting because the Fatima tie-in, because I believe Fatima was like the wife of Muhammad. It is an extremely common name among Muslims.
Really?
Because of that. And actually, that's why Our Lady of Fatima comes to Fatima and calls herself Our Lady of Fatima. And that's why the Muslim world, which is oftentimes converted by apparitions of Our Lady, she comes to them as Fatima.
Interesting.
Because it's a context that they can understand.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, you worship a false god. So it's kind of a cool part in there. And that's happening today in the present world.
Yeah.
Well, my favorite Sinbad story, there was two that I really loved.
Well, I think the one that you're going to say is... it's so great because this whole story, he's facing like these giant monsters and you're expecting the next big bad to be like crazy.
Well, we'll go to, that one's not my favorite, but that one's my second favorite.
Yeah.
So I know which one you're talking about. My actual favorite though was the story where essentially he comes back, he's shipwrecked. Then these people take him and eat the crew. So he's shipwrecked. They swim to the island. Next thing you know, these guys come and take him to the house, and he realizes that the food he's giving them is making all of his friends really fat and eat a lot. And so they're just basically fatting them like hogs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're grain-fed, and these beef is what they're doing because they're cannibals. And so he's like, I'm not going to eat. So he gets really weakly and small, and they stop looking at him, so he escapes.
Yeah.
And then he goes for 8 days and finally finds this town, and he meets the king once again, and the king marries him off to a noble lady. He forgets all about his home country, and he loves her and all that. And then eventually he has a friend that dies. And his friend, or his friend's wife dies, actually. And his friend comes to him distraught, and he says that, essentially, because his wife died, he will also die that next day. And he doesn't understand why. So he tells Sinbad that in their culture, if the wife or the husband dies, the other person is put in the pit as well.
Cast into a deep pit, just thrown in there.
Thrown into the pit. And I actually heard recently from one of our good friends that was telling me that that's a real thing that happened in cultures. I want to say India. Yeah. That was a real thing that actually used to happen. If a spouse died, the other spouse was cast in the pit. I will talk to him to confirm just to make sure. But I'm pretty sure he was saying that used to be a thing before the West got there and gave them, you know, civilization. They were doing this.
Because even Sinbad's appalled by this practice. Because he's like, what? You're going to...
Oh, yeah. Sinbad is certainly appalled by the... He's like, I don't want to do that. I wouldn't even got married if I did that.
Well, and then sure enough, what's next?
His wife dies. Sinbad's like, maybe I'll go home. Maybe I'll die before her. Please, Allah. And she dies. And then he's there and he's like, I wouldn't even married her at the funeral. I wouldn't even married this woman. This isn't my custom. You people are savages, whatever. And they still throw him into the pit. Well, when they would throw somebody into the pit, they give them like bread for 7 days, essentially, and a little bit of water.
Yeah.
And most people probably eat it right away and then just die. But he spaced it out for a couple days And so he survived. And then eventually there was a man who dies and comes into the pit, and the woman's dropped down with him. And so he grabs a femur bone of a human being and kills the woman. Yeah. And he takes her food and he survives.
Yeah. Which is like, I think this is the only story. Because, I mean, Sinbad, he's an opportunist and he's probably greedy. But this is the only story where I kind of like really questioned his character as a character. Because the first time he kills a woman, it's for survival, right? He's just trying to survive. But then he finds a way out to an island. And he keeps returning. And instead of telling the people there's a way out and coming and leading them to salvation, he just kills them and takes all their jewelry.
Yeah, but so he doesn't know, though. He's killing them just for sustenance at first because he hasn't found the way out yet.
Yeah.
Then he hears like an animal eating the dead bodies. And he kills multiple people and he eats the food. And so eventually this hears this animal and he chases him off. And he finds that there's a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. And he keeps running and he says it looks like the star. He thinks he sees like a star in the tunnel and he keeps running. And eventually he finds that the animals have made a little hole and get in and he gets out. And so he waits there because he's on a beach. Basically, he gets out on a beach, I guess like a mountain to a beach thing.
Yeah.
And he sees a boat. And when he sees his boat, he goes back in and he takes the jewelry and the clothes and everything off everybody he killed and who had been killed. And he takes that home with him.
Yeah.
And that's how he becomes rich off this journey. So yeah. it was fantastic and extremely dark and crazy. Just imagining.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. It's just that was a fascinating story. That was by far my favorite one just really? Because it sucked me in like that. I'm like, "Wait, what? What's happening?" Well,
cuz it starts
now?
Out like cuz typically you're waiting for the twist. There's always a twist in the story where he kind of like he finds something, he's shipwrecked, and then he meets these people and then there's a twist and a reason why he needs to go home. And so you're sitting here waiting because everything is way better than it should be. So you're waiting for the other foot to fall. And then sure enough, he has to die because his wife died. Yeah. Like, that's the twist. And he's like, wait a minute, what?
He's like, I don't even like her that much. Yeah, it's crazy.
Can you imagine that, though? If that was the kind of the Christian view on marriage? Because the whole purpose of the culture did it was because they didn't want you to marry anyone else. One, and there's some truth to that, right? We should be, like, bound to the soul and only have one wife. But yeah. Then again, it's like, but we don't need to kill each other.
Well,
that's
a distinction. Christian marriage is death does you part.
Yeah.
And so you are bound. You do become one flesh.
But once that flesh is gone.
Yeah. Once that flesh is gone.
Yeah.
You're free to do whatever you'd like to do at that point, whatever's moral, whatever you feel called to do, marry or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
Let's assume that this is something that a culture has actually done in the past.
Well, what happens to the kids?
Good question.
Do they throw the kids in there too?
No.
Surely not.
No, because then nobody would exist.
Which is kind of, I mean, obviously, we don't want to go too deep into these details because who knows if they're really true. But if there was a society, I would really be curious as to ask, like, what happens to the kids?
Yeah.
Does that give you a pass, maybe?
Yeah, that's one of the backwards ways of thinking because some people might look at this and go, well, that's beautiful.
It's honorable.
It's honorable in marriage how you truly do become one, but it's just such a bad understanding of what marriage is and that death does actually do its part.
Listen to the previous episode.
Yeah, exactly.
We won't go on that tirade again.
Yeah. This book really gave such a dim view of marriage and such a dim view of women. And it was hard to piece out whether that was a stereotype that Sir Richard Burton was putting forth about the Arabic people.
Yeah.
Or if that's actually a true part of the culture.
One of the good things from this book, and I feel like obviously we're Christian-based, both of us are Christians, is that something we can really admire from this Muslim culture, and it's here to some degree in Christian culture, just not as much in the American culture that we live in, is their constant praise of Allah. Their constant praise of Allah, and it mentions their morning prayer, their evening prayer, constantly. And that's something that's very respectable about this culture, and it's something that's it's almost foreign as I read it. Is that they're constantly praising Allah in the good and the bad.
At first, it's off-putting because anytime you hear Allah as a Christian, it's kind of weird.
We're you got to get past that negative connotation if you're going to read this one.
But that's beautiful. Every story just mentions it multiple times in an actual prayer. In the West nowadays, we have Jesus Christ, his name be praised. It's just a swear word. It's the only time it's used.
Yeah,
and even that's been one of the big critiques of some of the present day theologians or in the hierarchy of the church, if they write a document, a lot of the ways people criticize the specific documents is they'll look at the number of times the word Jesus is mentioned.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And it's not being mentioned that much. It's a sad thing because this used to be part of our culture, and actually in Czech culture, there used to be a phrase that was said to greet one another, and it wasn't hello or jak se máš, which means how are you. That's not what we said. It was something to the extent of Jesus Christ be praised, and with like a now and forever response, but it was all in Czech.
Yeah.
And that was very common. Of every Western society, civilization had a phrase that was common that people used to say when they entered houses.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd get the holy water and they would say, Christ be praised now and forever, or whatever it was in their specific language. And that's totally lost. And so nowadays we...
Well, there's something to be said about whatever your worldview is in your religion. There's just a commonality between friends there, right? If I walk up to you and I'm like, glory to Jesus Christ.
Now and forever.
Yeah. It's just immediately we are bonded.
Yep.
We're bonded with a higher power. And it just, the hierarchy of that worldview is correct. There's a higher power above us that both of us worship, that both of us are identified with. And so it initially gets that commonality between friends and strangers. Like even if you walk up to a stranger, glory to Jesus Christ. And if they say glory forever or now and forever, it's like, okay, cool. We have that in common. And so I think, yep. That has been lost. And that's something that's really amazing within the Arabian Nights is that.
That is still there. It's really commendable and beautiful the way that is done. Now their idea of God, obviously, some of the things they pray for are really strange. And
well, we got some disagreements, obviously.
Yeah.
You know.
But it's cool to see that for sure.
Yeah.
What did you think about Aladdin?
The story was fun. I just don't like Aladdin the character. I didn't find him to be a likable character. Honestly, I don't know if that's super important. If the character needs to be likable, I feel like the character needs to be somewhat likable so you can identify with them and what they're doing within the story. But Aladdin, I didn't find him to be a likable guy at all. When he wasn't rich, he was kind of this degenerate kid in the streets who like lied and cheated his way or whatever. But then when he's rich, you know, he gives alms and gives to the poor and all that. But like, he only does that because he got the easy way out with the genie. I didn't find him likable, I guess.
I didn't really find him too likable either. But I did love the story, and it's totally different than the story that you see on Disney.
Probably the biggest similarity is when Aladdin goes into the cave to get the lamp. That one is pretty spot on with the movie and how Jafar wants Aladdin to toss him the lamp, but Aladdin's like, no. The details are different, but that's kind of the basic idea, and that's pretty similar. Everything else, though, way different.
Did you find a theme? What was the whole point of the story, do you think?
I don't know, man. I kept expecting there to be some sort of consequence from using this lamp. I mean, if you haven't seen Aladdin, there's this magic lamp, you rub it, a genie comes out who grants wishes. Even in the Disney movie, it's like, what is it? He only gets 3 wishes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you have that kind of like, you need to be sparing with what you want. Not here. That he comes out, he only objects one time, which is kind of random.
And it's in order to save his life.
Yeah. Other than that, there was no consequence to him using this lamp. It's even in the beginning of the story, his mother is like, hey, you shouldn't do this. This is the dark arts. Like, you shouldn't deal with this. This isn't good. And so it makes you feel like it's almost against the religion, or it's, you know, quote unquote, demonic. And so it makes you think that eventually there's going to be some sort of consequence for him using the lamp. But there really never is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the guy comes back and he has to deal with that. But like, he gets it back and he lives his best life.
Yeah. But I think if there was one thing about the story that stuck out to me, it's not that the lamp isn't the important part at all. It's that love transforms him, Aladdin. Love ultimately is what draws him out of himself and makes him go from being a never-do-well person, a no-gooder, to the king of this entire place. And so the story basically goes, Aladdin is a never-do-well person, and he's just always stealing from people, and his dad dies and he didn't want to take on the family business, so his mom's like a spinster and is just spinning yarn, and that's all they make their living, which doesn't give a lot of money. He's just basically eating off his mom and then leaving her.
He's actually a young boy in the story, but he's basically the 40-year-old man living in his mom's basement not doing anything. That's who Aladdin was before he got a hold of the lamp.
And so then this guy comes in who's a magician from Africa, but he doesn't know it, and he claims to be his long lost uncle. And so he takes him and promises him the world, essentially. And then he knows that Aladdin is the only one who can go and get this lamp.
Oh, I'll show you the world.
Yeah.
Is that how it goes? Sorry. That's
if all there, I can think if about. There is a magic carpet ride in the story, it's the uncle who does it to Aladdin. So the magician. And so he gives him this ring, essentially, and he tells him that there's a genie attached to it and that he'll do whatever he needs. And then to go down into this cave and skip these four quadrants, but go to the fifth one, and there you will find this lamp. Get this lamp, and then also you can get diamonds off these trees that are there, or rubies. And so they do that. And then what happens is he's coming up, but his pockets are so full that he can't get the lamp out to give to his uncle. And so his uncle, who is the magician, who's not really his uncle, gets so frustrated with it because all he wants is a lamp, to the point where he covers him in and basically leaves him to die. But then he's out of frustration. He rubs his hands together, and the ring that he has actually has a genie pop out of it. He has to be set back on the land.
Which is that's such a wild detail that I don't like this story for several reasons.
Yeah.
And one of them is just, the magician has a genie the whole time who grants wishes. Why does he need the lamp?
Aladdin has the ring, which works just fine too. Why does he need the lamp in the first place?
I don't know if maybe that genie's not as powerful as the lamp genie. Yeah, I don't know.
That's kind of what they
say. It's probably because it's not Robin Williams, you know?
That's what it is. Yeah, nobody would be as powerful as Robin Williams. So then he goes back home and he's tired and he tells his mom what happens. And he says he's hungry and he needs some food. So his mom goes to just sell the lamp, but at first she wants to clean it up. She rubs her hand against it. The genie pops out, scares her half to death.
Yeah.
Which is what it would do to any normal person. So he goes in and he rubs it after her and asks for a meal. And the genie brings like so much gold and platters full of food. They eat. He sells the platters. Yada, yada, yada. The story goes on until
he catches sight of the princess.
Catches sight of the princess and decides he wants to have her. She's the most beautiful woman he's ever seen. He falls in love at first sight. So he tries to get his mom to go and talk to the king into letting him wife her. And she's like, look, we're poor. Your dad was a tailor. You're a never-do-well guy.
I mean, no nobility in our family.
We have nothing. What are we going to do? So the mom eventually goes because he's like, I'll die if this doesn't happen. He loves her so much. And eventually the king listens, tries to marry his daughter off to somebody else.
The sultan, he kind of slights Aladdin a little bit because he promises after like 60 or 30 days or something like that, he's going to give him his daughter. But then he goes back on that because he kind of promised his daughter to his other guy. So they're going to get married. But then Aladdin's like, oh, no. And so he rubs the lamp and tells the genie on their wedding night, you know, when they're going into the marriage bed. And he just disrupts their whole night because he tells the genie to go and get them and bring them to him. And the genie goes, picks up their bed with them in it, and brings it and sets it down in Aladdin's room. And he tells the genie to take the guy, take him somewhere else. And he takes him to this, like, apparently, like, cold closet space or something like that.
Yeah, to the water closet, to the restroom or
wardrobe. And the guy's, like, freezing to death. And he lays in the bed with the princess with a sword between them. He pretty much tells her, like, hey, I'm not going to do anything to you. I just don't want you to lay with this guy.
Yep, with the scimitar between them the whole night. Which shows that Aladdin does have some
honor.
He's starting to gain a little bit of honor at that point. The love is drawing him out of himself at this point. And so this happens twice. And eventually the guy's like, look, I'm bowing out. I'm not about to do this. Like, I'm going to end up dead.
You ain't worth it.
Yeah, you're not worth it. And so then Aladdin, the sultan, asked for greater shows of glory, and Aladdin is able to procure that.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually the sultan gives his daughter to Aladdin in marriage, and she sees him, and when she sees him, she falls in love with him at first sight.
Yeah.
When she sees his wealth, of course, and sees his handsomeness. So then he builds this beautiful palace in one night that is impossible to build with all these riches and rubies, and the sultan can't afford that level of wealth even. And so this uncle, you know, this fake uncle, comes back and he decides that he's going to take this lamp and he's going to kill Aladdin because that's what he's wanted all the whole time, is the lamp. So the lady who's married to Aladdin basically gets swindled by the magician into giving what she thinks is this old ugly lamp that does nothing to the magician for like a new lamp. They just make this trade. And then he takes the whole palace with her in it and her slaves and all that, and he moves them to Africa.
Which is like, I feel like the equivalent of that with my marriage is if like, I'm kind of a borderline hoarder, you know? She had to really tone that down in me a little bit. And I feel like the equivalent of this is like, she were to go into my one keepsake box, pull out some like old coins I got from my grandma. I was like, oh yeah, I'll take a new one for this. I'll just give this away.
Yeah.
What woman would do that?
But see, so she doesn't know that it's important at all. Because Aladdin hasn't really made it a big deal. He's never shown her that the genie comes out. And he doesn't get mad at her for it. This is kind of her Eve moment in the garden. This is the moment where the serpent comes in and tricks her with cunning. And it's really Adam's fault because he's not guarding the garden. It's really Aladdin's fault because he just put that anywhere. He didn't keep it on him. It's such a prized thing. He just left it there. It wasn't special to him in any way that she knew. But he loves her so much, he also doesn't get mad at her.
But he has also hasn't revealed the secret of the lamp to her. So I feel like he can't get too mad, because if he reveals too much to her, she may not love him anymore.
Yeah.
Right? And that's kind of similar with the Disney movie.
Well, and I think he just loves her. Like, I think he legitimately just loves her. There's nothing that his bride that could do that would make him think less of her or not understand. So Aladdin rubs a ring, and he gets a ride over, you know, the genie picks him up and takes him to Africa. And while he's there, he...
Well, I don't know if you said this part, but the magician, after he gets the lamp, he pretty much says, like, hey, I'm taking the palace with me back to my homeland. And the genie picks up the whole palace and takes it to Africa with him. You know, and then, yeah, and then Aladdin uses his other genie to take him there.
And then he sees his wife, and they talk and meet and have a joyful encounter and love each other and all that kind of stuff. And he tells her to act like she's forgot about him for one night, to go and dine with him and drink wine and tell him it's their custom, and give it to for him to drink wine from her hand. And so she has one of her maids put in this liquid that essentially poison. Is poison.
Yeah.
And so she poisons the magician, and then Aladdin comes in and he finishes off the job with his sword.
Yeah.
With the lamp. He tells the genie to take the palace back.
Which I was reading this and I was like, there has to be a consequence for this lamp. There has to be. And so I half expected him to bring the palace back and the Sultan be like weeping over the soil where the palace was for his lost daughter. And they crush the Sultan with the whole house.
Funny. I just thought the Sultan would be like, this is black magic. You need to leave.
Yeah.
Leave my daughter alone.
Nah, man. The tourism's been off the chain since Aladdin got there, bro.
He never worried about it. So, and then his brother, the magician, has a brother who is conjuring spirits
is
a necromancer and, you know, speaks to the dead. And
some of the details in this story, I'm sorry I keep interrupting you, man, but some of the details here, it honestly reminds me of like a Hispanic telenovela. You think the story's about to wrap up, then it's like, dun, 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 the evil twin brother has returned.
Yeah, I was like, how do we have 10 more pages? Oh, wait, here we go.
Yeah. It's just at the very tail end. Oh, yeah, he had a brother. It's not over yet.
And this brother is more cunning than the other magician and really wants to kill.
Yeah.
So the brother goes and hears about this wonderful lady, the Lady of Fatima, who is a saintly woman. And you can tell right away that she's not a saintly woman, because he goes into her and he lays on top of her with a knife, and he threatens to kill her if she will not make him look like her. And instead of dying as a martyr, which would be, you know, I'd go, oh, she was probably Catholic. Instead of dying as a saintly martyr, she makes him look like her and then dies as a harlot, essentially, because she just did whatever he wanted. And then so made him look like her with makeup, or I guess it was more magic, but
yeah.
I'm thinking makeup because I don't know how else.
I think it's makeup, because he says, like, put some of this powder or paste on my face or something like that, yeah. I think.
So then this really masculine woman, who's parading around in a habit, goes and befriends Aladdin's wife. So the snake once again enters the garden, and she's just...
This is a perfect plot for like a 2024 movie, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Men being women and... Sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
Get off my
Absolutely. Being evil. Men who act like women are always evil. But he goes and he seduces her, essentially, into believing that he's this saintly woman and that he should live in the palace. And she, like, convinces him to live there, basically. Gives him this room because she wants to learn from him and all that. And so, ultimately, the way that the magician tries to get Aladdin killed this time is he tells her that her palace is so beautiful, but all it's missing is the roca bird, or the rock bird.
Yeah.
And that she should ask Aladdin, you know, to bring this in with this bird, it'd be perfect. And so he rubs the lamp and the genie saves his life. The genie refuses and says, this magician is living in your house and he's trying to kill you because if I bring this bird here, this bird will kill you.
Yeah.
Just like it did to Sinbad, you know, dropping the stones on the ship and everything. This bird will just kill you. And so that's a suicide thing to ask for. And so Aladdin doesn't tell anything to his wife.
Yeah.
But rather he calls the genie forward because he says he's got such a headache and he wants her to pray for him. And when
not the genie, the magician disguised as the saintly woman.
Yes, that's right. The magician disguised as a saintly woman. And he sees the magician try to go for his dagger when he's about to put his hands on him. And so he grabs the magician's dagger and kills him.
Yeah.
And so that's how the story ends, essentially.
Pretty much. Like, that's all it is.
And the lady's like, why would you kill this saintly woman? And he's like, look, and he removes the face mask.
Scooby-Doo style.
It's Scooby-Doo, and it's a full bearded man. Like, they make sure they put it in there that he has a full beard.
Yeah, and his mustachio.
Yeah, he didn't want to shave it. He's like, no, I'm keeping the beard.
Yeah.
I mean, that happens nowadays, too, with men acting like women. Sometimes you'll see him with a full beard. But, oh, the tie-ins are endless. No. So, that's kind of the whole story, which is crazy. But to me, the story is, I mean, it's a stretch, because a lot of, there's two lanes you could take the route of the genie and the magic being the thing that really changes his life. But to me, more than anything, it's the love of this woman who he loves at first sight. It's nothing like the Aladdin Disney movie. There's no courting between them. There's no talking until they're married.
Yeah.
And she sees him and she loves him at first sight as well.
I don't know, man. I kind of see that. I kind of see, because I get, after you described it, I kind of see how, like, as you go on, the love for the Sultan, the love for the woman has kind of changed him in a way, because he's also super generous with his wealth.
Oh, yeah. It's changed him completely.
Yeah.
From being one who just takes and takes from other people to one who actually is giving lavishly. Now, he couldn't do that without the lamp.
Exactly.
But he's also, every move he makes, even though it's just lavishly spent and all that, it's spent for her. I'm spending this money because I want to win this beautiful woman.
Yeah.
Whom I love.
I don't know, man.
I mean, definitely without the genie. But the reason I think of it that way is because there's a lot of guys in our culture, in our day and age, who are 30 years old living in their mom's basement with no future ideas about their life, about what should I do with my life? Why is life worth living? And the question for me in my ministry has also always been, what do I do to help those guys live real life? How do we get these guys to go out of themselves to actually want to live in the real world, not just live off their mom? But how do we help these guys get married, do whatever, go on an adventure, whatever it is? And I think the answer is love.
Find a good woman.
Find a good one, which is always the most cliche answer is always love.
Yeah.
And it's the one that doesn't make sense. But
it's just like, I feel like it's a double-edged sword, though, man, because this guy living in his mom's basement or whoever, if we're going to keep using that metaphor, it's just like, so are these guys just going to wait around till a genie arrives, till he wins the lottery, till he gets a dream job, till this magical supermodel walks into his house and and falls in love with him?
I think the moving force is love. And I think that's what we've gotten wrong with a lot of these guys. We've told them you listen to Ben Shapiro. They'll say, you know, if you want to be happy, the way that you're happy is you waited till you're married to have kids. You got a GED, you were married, and then you had kids. You do those three things in those order, you'll be happy. You will have a higher income. You will have done things right, and this is what you do to have a happy life. That's not what moves anybody. These statistics will never move anybody.
Yeah.
What moves people is love.
Yeah.
Stories move us and shape us, and we have to tell stories about love. And I think this could be partially that. I mean, if he doesn't have the genie, it doesn't work out. But from the moment he sees her, his whole life goes from getting money and just surviving, because he's even given away the golden platters for less money than they're worth because he just has no idea.
Yeah, he doesn't know.
He's like, oh yeah, here's one dirham, you know, take it for this huge golden platter. And one of the guys, like, he makes a comment about the guy buying it being Jewish.
Yeah, there's definitely some, a little bit of a...
He's like, he swindled you out of this. You should have came to a fellow Muslim brother.
Yeah.
And I would have given you 70 dirhams for this, and that's what he ends up getting for it.
Yeah.
But then even then, he's just kind of living. He's not going above and beyond. He doesn't build a palace or anything.
Well, it's more than he's ever had.
It's more than he's ever had, but he's using it to just buy food. He's not doing anything big until he meets the princess.
Changes his life.
And that transforms his life. Now he's got the money to do the things he needs to do. But for the first time, he goes out. I mean, that was what was shocking to me throughout this book is, why does he not immediately say, build me a palace somewhere off, make it seem like I'm a prince? That's what you'd think was first step. No, he still lives in his mom's, you know, kind of shack.
Yeah.
And the princess is so scared when he takes her to his bedroom on her wedding night with the other guy, when he has a genie go pick her up and bring her there. She's like, it was so dark and hideous.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why didn't you just transform the house? That doesn't make sense. But so I think love is the moving force, or that's the way I'm going to view it.
Well, I guess in that story, if we're just talking about the story in general, he had to have been disguised because he didn't want her to know this was his origins, right?
She doesn't recognize him, but they never talk about it again until the end of the story.
Did they talk about it?
They talk about it because she says, I thank Allah that you saved me on my wedding night with the other guy.
I thought it was just like, I'm thanking Allah for saving me on the wedding night.
Well, it might be that.
Yeah. Cause I don't think he ever reveals it. I don't know if she ever knows, you know, which that's kind of the big twist in like the Disney film is that she finds out that Aladdin isn't this rich prince, but she loves him anyway. You know, and that very well could have been the case with this one. I didn't catch that.
But. No, I didn't. That was the one time it was mentioned. Another I'm not sure if she was saying that.
I'm not sure if the magic carpet, the flying carpet's from another story. But because there wasn't a flying carpet in this one. There was a carpet, but it wasn't a flying one.
It's just really long.
Yeah. They would roll this carpet out and it would go from his palace to the Sultan's palace so they could ride, they could go have direct contact to each other without having to walk the streets.
And he did it overnight.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot of beautiful stuff, though, with love in this story, too, of Aladdin on his horse. And the Sultan's like, tell him to bring his horse all the way into the courtyard, basically.
Yeah.
Ride straight in.
Yeah.
And there's something beautiful about that.
Yeah.
One other thing I got. Did you have anything else about this specific one?
I don't think we never came back around to Sinbad in the funny story. Of
oh no, great timing. Yeah, Sinbad.
we could try to wrap up with this one if we wanted to, but yeah. So one of Sinbad's stories. So it's like I was saying earlier, you have these big bad monsters that Sinbad's facing and going on adventures and having to overcome these giant obstacles, but then this one story. He gets shipwrecked like normal. He's on this island and he meets this man who's this like crippled man who's laying on the ground. He can't move anywhere. And the crippled man pretty much like says, hey, can you please carry me to get something to eat? And Aladdin's like, yes, I'll do this for you if you can show me where to get things to eat kind of thing. It's kind of a give and take. But as soon as Aladdin puts the man on his shoulders, the man like jujitsus him and locks his legs around him. And won't let go. So Aladdin has this man on his shoulders for like months. And he's just living life with a man on his shoulders and carrying him around because the man's like, if you don't do this, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah. It's great. Yeah. He's basically, that's what I thought was so cool was this is like straight up jujitsu. It's like he took his neck.
He put him in a triangle by being on his shoulders.
Yeah. And then he would navigate him based upon where he put his legs. Like he would force him to do that, you know.
I can just see him doing like super quick leg changes.
Yeah.
Like, come this way, go like Ratatouille style, you know?
And the funny thing is, you're like, man, this guy must have had tons of strength. How do you fight jujitsu? How do you jujitsu a person for months on end? I mean, that's so impractical. Yeah. But it was just funny. And
it was such a simple, like, it's simple, but it's so out there. Like, of all the different fantasy creatures that he could have encountered on this island,
this is just this
crippled, fake crippled man who. He doesn't feel like walking, so I'm going to make this guy walk for me.
And this crippled guy, apparently he does this a lot, which is what they say in the story. They're like, oh, this is why people don't come to our island, because this crippled guy just randomly does this.
This old hobo down the street, no one likes.
And eventually, Sinbad, you know, gets some wine, and he starts drinking wine, but he's actually virtuous, Sinbad, in some ways. He's not overindulgent when it comes to wine, just like the food when he was in the cave. He kind of drinks a little bit to cheer his heart, but he doesn't go beyond, he doesn't get drunk. Yeah. And so the guy who's on his back notices that he starts singing and is joyful and has forgot that he's got the guy on his back and is kind of living his life once again. And so the old guy asks for wine and he drinks to the point of getting drunk. He's not virtuous. He's living in that vice. drinks to the point of getting drunk, lets his legs go for a second, and Sinbad, you know, takes him off, throws him on the ground, and bashes his head in with a stone.
It's just so violent, man.
Yeah, so violent. That's kind of the interesting thing about this book is you get a lot of that. But that's why I think...
Which is so... And that's another thing about this book, too. It's like we keep saying, like, the imagination, right? There's no way in real life a man could live on someone's shoulders for months on end.
No way.
And not get tired and not let go of his legs. But in this story, it really makes you believe, like, this is just Sinbad's life now.
Yeah.
He has this parasite on his shoulders that won't let go ever, you know? But it's just an old man, you know?
Yeah. That was a little bit of a type of confession. You know, that's the way you feel after you got this old man on your shoulders. He's weighing you down. The whores or whatever were in your life beforehand, and you go to confession for the first time, and that old man is taken off your shoulders, and he's just bashed in the brains. You feel the weight just lifted. I can't imagine. That's the only thing that I have to tie it into, of like, what would that feel like? I mean, he slept with the man. The man was like literally on his back even when he was sleeping. He was always there. He was the monkey on the back that some people have, and that's the only thing I could tie it into.
Always pulling the moral out of the story. Go to confession,
That isn't there. Go to confession. It isn't there, but it's there in my mind. But this story, that was a beautiful thing about it, the imagination. One of Sinbad's stories, he's shipwrecked, but basically they're on an island, and then all of a sudden they start making iron. They have all these like iron pots and stuff, and they're starting to boil water for their clothes. And then they realize that the island is a fish. It's this humongous fish, and the fires disrupt it. And so it basically takes off for the bottom of the sea.
Yeah.
And so just that image, what does it look like to be on top of a fish that you think that is so big that you think it's an island?
Which that's one of the stories, because if you've ever seen, there was a Sinbad animated movie that came out. Like, it had some big stars, like Brad Pitt was Sinbad, and he voiced Sinbad, you know?
Yeah, that's cool. I never saw that.
I watched it a bunch as a kid, and I really enjoyed it. Because the fish on the island is the distinct memory I have from it, of them realizing this island that they're on is a giant fish, and they're all trying to get off the island as fast as they can before the fish takes to the water, you know?
Nice.
I feel like if we take anything away from this, it's the wonder and imagination that these stories bring, you know, and the great feat of how wonderful a collection of stories this really is. And even if we want to kind of maybe tone it down, get the Andrew Lang version, I do see myself reading some of these stories to my boys.
Me too.
You got, God willing, I have boys, plural. I got one on the way, but even my little girl, these are still good stories for her too, you know?
No, I love, my favorite part about reading this story so far has been just talking with you about it. I think that it's been a lot of fun. This conversation has been fun in a way that reading the book wasn't necessarily fun all the time.
Well, sometimes it's the communion with these type of things that makes it fun. I've always wanted to be part of like a book club. And honestly, that's kind of the reason I agreed to do this with you, right? Because it's a great excuse to read great books, right? And not do it by yourself, because that's fun sometimes, but it's always fun to like bounce back ideas with each other and do things together. Like you pulled something out of Aladdin that I didn't really get. Like, I didn't like Aladdin at all. But you kind of expounded some stuff that I didn't really take from it, which helps me understand things that I didn't before, which is why doing things in community is something we should do. Right. And we hope that whoever's listening to this, if you want to take up the challenge and read these books with us, it'll enrich the experience even more, and you won't just be listening to us ramble about random stories, you know?
Take it up and read it. And if you're an old man, you know, read the saucy book, that's fine. Get the same version we did. Go for it.
Which is to say, we did find, because I want to buy these books, and I want to buy beautiful books to have on the bookshelf so my kids can pull them off and read them one day. And this book is quite beautiful. Has this blue cover. It's like hardcover. Is it leather? It's probably some type of leather, right? It's got a ribbon in it, and the pages are like gold tipped, like a Bible is, you know? Not to say it's equal to the Bible, obviously, but it's just beautiful, right?
Yep.
And it goes to show like the splendor of the book and the wonders that it beholds, kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. No, I love the story. I thought it was really interesting. And just that... the storytelling is such an important part. You know, what would our world be like if we started telling stories once again to people?
That's one thing I've always admired about. Like, I had one of my best friends growing up, his mom, she was a great storyteller. She could just be telling like her, you know, her sister did this the other day. And just the way she told it, you were just drawn in. And you loved it, right? And I've always wanted that skill of being able to tell a story. I don't have it yet.
Yeah.
I hope I can eventually gain it from reading these books and reading them to my kids and telling these stories, you know? And that's something I really admired in some people, and I hope that I can do.
That's what I hope to do as well. And that's why I really like Uncle Cy from Duck Dynasty. He's got a podcast called The Duck Call Room, and he's just such a good storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, how much better of a place would our world be if we stopped gossiping so much and we told stories to each other?
Yeah.
We'd be a different place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you don't take anything that we say away, just take away the fact that you should read these books. That is something virtuous that you should do for your life and for your children and for your family.
And if this conversation leads you to sin, then stop listening to our podcast.
Immediately.
And pray for us.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. But so we can wrap up with that. The next book that we're going to be going through is by Hellock Belair, which is a very interesting figure that I've been trying. I want to read his academic works.
Belair Belloc.
Oh, did I get it backwards?
Yeah.
Belloc Belair.
Yeah.
That shows you how much I know about him, right?
No, that's all
right. But no, he was a contemporary of G.K. Chesterton, yeah, right? They were really good friends. So we're going to be reading his children's book. So the version we got, we originally just wanted to do one, but the version that we're going to read comes with two. One of them is called Cautionary Tales, and the other one is called The Bad Child's Book of Beasts. And so these are moral lessons for children, right? And I've started some of it, read most of it already, which is, it's fascinating, and I love it, and I can't wait to talk about it. But we hope that you guys could, if you guys want to join us, that'd be wonderful. It's an easy read, so if you want to jump in at any point in this podcast, this is the perfect time, because it is a super easy read. It is something that you could read to your kids right now, even if you have like a two-year-old. Right. It's that simple. It's just poems. So we really, really wish you guys, we hope that you guys join us in reading that. So with all that being said, all those out there listening, never forget that we were made for the stars, yet planted in the soil. Thanks.